Today is November the 7th, 2018. November the 11th is Veterans Day, but it is designated as a federal holiday observed this year on November the 12th. It was originally called Armistice Day when World War I ended on the 11th hour of the 11th minute on November 11th, 1918. It was renamed Veterans Day by Congress in June of 1954 to commemorate veterans of all wars. President Ronald Reagan established this special holiday as a day to honor all American veterans. We thank them for their service. Back to the computing home front. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. We are on WBAI-FM tonight. If you have any questions for us, just send us email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. The Supreme Court declines to take on net neutrality. In a setback for industry groups, the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday declined to hear a number of challenges to Obama-era net neutrality regulations that barred internet service providers from giving certain customers preferential treatment. The Trump administration overturned those regulations last year, and since June they have not been in effect. But a range of challenges to the regulations remain before the court brought by groups like the United States Telecom Association, AT&T, and the Internet and Television Association. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday announced that it would not take up challenges to Obama-era net neutrality regulations that barred Internet service providers from giving certain customers preferential treatment. The Trump administration overturned those regulations last year, and since June they have not been in effect. But a range of challenges to the regulations remain before the court, brought by groups such as the United States Telecom Association, AT&T, and the Internet and Television Association. The court's decision will leave in effect a decision from a federal appeals court in Washington upholding the constitutionality of the regulation. That means that the decision can be relied on for precedent in the future. Three of the court's conservative justices, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch, said they would have vacated that decision. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh recused themselves. Therefore, they didn't have the necessary four votes to review the appeal. Net neutrality has proved divisive, with proponents arguing that it is the foundation of free and open internet and opponents casting it as an unlawful seizure of power by the FCC. By the way, the FCC is the Federal Communications Commission. The FCC decision to do away with the Obama-era regulation is now facing a court challenge in Washington. What's my view on net neutrality? It is not necessarily shared by my colleagues, and it only represents my point of view. We hear the term net neutrality. What is net neutrality? It is the principle that internet service providers should enable access to all content and applications regardless of the source and without favoring or blocking particular products or websites. I'm all for that. Most people get their high-speed internet access from only a few telecommunications giants like AT&T, Comcast, Cox, CenturyLink, Charter, and Verizon. When we send or receive data over the internet, we expect those companies to transfer that data from one end of the network to the other end, period. We don't expect them to analyze or manipulate it. In 2015, the Federal Communications Commission has had protection in place to prevent broadband providers from doing just that. But now the FCC is moving to do away with those protections. ISPs operate as a gatekeeper between customers and online content providers and have the incentive and ability to use that position to threaten internet openness. So far, there's been no evidence that ISPs have actually done that, and it's just dire warnings issued by advocates of the regulations. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is an independent government agency responsible for regulating the radio, television, and phone industries. The FCC regulates all interstate communications, such as wire, satellite, and cable, and international communications originating or terminating in the United States. A coalition of internet giants, including Alphabet, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and others, has urged a U.S. appeals court to reinstate federal and net neutrality regulations on internet service providers. But when it comes to keeping the internet free and open, these companies, however, have managed openness of content. Net neutrality is not applicable to these companies. The agency in charge of policing Facebook and Google is the Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC. Net neutrality is not applicable to these content providers. But in the case of Google, they also happen to be an internet service provider. Only they refer to themselves as fiber service provider. An example is the Link NYC network installed in New York City. Google Fiber offers internet plans with data speed up to 1,000 megabits per second. Google Fiber is part of the Access division of Alphabet Inc. It provides fiber to the premise service in the United States, providing broadband internet and IPTV to an increasing number of locations. Google Fiber has over 68,000 television subscribers and was estimated to have over 450,000 broadband customers. Google Fiber Services is operating in Stanford University, Kansas City, Austin, Provo, Salt Lake City, Charlotte, Atlanta, Research Triangle, which is Raleigh-Durham, and Nashville, Tennessee. Is Google an ISP? Not according to the FCC. I'm really for net neutrality, but it should not be applicable to only those regulated by the FCC, and it is not applicable to companies regulated by the FTC. Putting restraints on those companies regulated by the FCC will only enable Google to have a bigger stranglehold on the entire internet. It is time for Congress to rewrite the law to reflect changes in technology. If you have a certain point of view that differs from mine or you agree with mine, I'd be happy to receive email from you. Just send me email to hank@pcradioshow.org. China has been hijacking the vital internet backbone of Western countries. A China state-owned telecom company has been hijacking the vital internet backbone, according to an academic paper published by researchers from the U.S. Naval War College and Tel Aviv University. The culprit is China Telecom, the country's third largest telecom and internet service provider, which has had a presence inside North American networks since the early 2000s when it created its first point-of-presence sites. Point-of-presence are data centers that do nothing more than reroute traffic between all the smaller networks that make up the larger network. These smaller networks are known as autonomous systems, and they can be part of the networks of big tech companies like Google, your ISP, Verizon, university networks, bank networks, web hosting companies, and all other entities big enough to have received their own block of IP addresses. Traffic travels between these autonomous system networks with the help of the Border Gateway Protocol, that's BGP. This protocol was created in the early 1980s and does not have any security controls, and this allows anyone to send and receive traffic that was not intended for their network. In the vast majority of cases, these incidents happen because of configuration mistakes and are resolved in minutes or hours. But there are some networks that hijack these routes to send legitimate traffic through malicious servers. They do this to carry out phishing attacks, to steal passwords, or to record encrypted data to be later decrypted. The researchers say they've built a route tracing system monitoring the accidental or deliberate hijacking. They've tracked down hijacks to 10 points of presence sites, 8 in the United States and 2 in Canada, that China Telecom have been silently and slowly setting up in North America since the early 2000s. Using these numerous points of presence sites, China Telecom has already seamlessly hijacked the domestic U.S. and cross-U.S. traffic and redirected it to China over days, weeks, and months. In their paper, the researchers list several long-lived hijacks that have had traffic for a particular network and have it take a long detour through China's telecom network in mainland China before letting it reach its intended and final destination. They cited the following. Starting from February 2016 and for about 6 months, routes from Canada to Korean government sites by China Telecom and rerouted through China. On October 2016, traffic from several locations in the United States to a large Anglo-American bank headquarters in Milan, Italy, was hijacked by China Telecom to China. Traffic from Sweden and Norway to the Japanese network of a large American news organization was hijacked to China for about 6 weeks from April to May in 2017. Traffic to the mail server and other IP addresses of a large financial company in Thailand was hijacked several times during April, May, and July of 2017. Some of the hijack attacks started in the USA, buried in a nation's infrastructure, but now we really should be addressing a requirement for urgent policy response and get some security in. The prevalence of such ease, which one can simply redirect and copy data by controlling key transit nodes, need to be addressed where the infrastructure requires urgent policy response. Spam robocalls will soon account for almost 50% of all calls. No, it's not your imagination. The amount of spam phone calls has gotten worse. According to new data from First Orion, the amount of junk calls will reach 46% by mid-year 2019. And by the end of next year, the amount is projected to finally cross the halfway point. Collecting data from 50 billion calls over the past 18 months, the company noticed a sharp rise in calls that were robocalls, many of which used neighborhood spoofing techniques to entice people to pick up by having a fake caller ID that resembles the caller's number. The numbers weren't nearly this high even a year ago. Last year, in 2017, mobile call scams made up just only 3.7% of the total call volume, very low. But this year, in 2018, the number had shot up sharply to 29.2%, and projections for spam calls look on track to hit the halfway mark of all call volume next year. Consumers are complaining more than ever. The FTC received 63,000 complaints about illegal robocalls each month in 2009. That number ballooned to 375,000 complaints a month in 2017. Scammers have also shifted almost completely to mobile. In 2017, 17% of scam and spam calls were to cell phones. Now the number of scam and spam calls to cell phones has hit 69%. As these numbers rise, spoofing is getting worse. People used to simply get calls from numbers similar to their own number in order to trick them into thinking it's someone from their family. As these numbers rise, anecdotal spoofing is getting worse. People used to simply get calls from numbers similar to their own in order to trick them into thinking it's someone from their family. But anecdotally, neighborhood spoofing has been evolving to target using area codes and numbers that are similar to other numbers they've connected to, such as a place they used to live or a family member town. Blocking, according to First Orion, is not an effective solution anymore, as many phone numbers aren't actually spam lines, but rather legitimate numbers that got hijacked. While the increase in the percentage of spam calls is due to higher gross volume of spam calls, First Orion data says that the number of clean calls is dropping 10% to 20% overall each year. By 2023, mobile call revenue may collapse because people simply won't be answering the phone as much. But today, it's not the case, as billions are lost every year as consumers fall victim to scams. Caller ID spoofing is the practice of causing the telephone network to indicate to the receiver of a call that the originator of the call is a station other than the true originating station. Caller ID spoofing is a service that allows a caller to masquerade as someone else by falsifying the number that appears on the recipient's caller ID display. The National Do Not Call Registry gives you a choice about whether to receive telemarketing calls. You can register your home or mobile phone for free. However, this Do Not Call Registry is totally useless. The robocall spammers just access this list and use a spoof number to enable them to take advantage of this list. In New York State, politicians and nonprofit organizations are exempt from Do Not Call restrictions. I might see the rationale to make an exemption for a nonprofit organization, but to exempt politicians from using the Do Not Call list to make spam calls? Hey, that's a total farce. Umail, a company that collects and analyzes calls through its robocall blocking service, reported an estimate 3.4 billion, that's with a B, 3.4 billion robocalls in the month of April this year. The worst affected areas were, I guess you might be surprised to hear it. It is Atlanta, Georgia, with the exchange code of 404. Overall, if you combine 404 and an exchange code 678, those two combined in the Atlanta area accounted for over 105 million robocalls just in the month of April. What's going on in Atlanta? That's a lot of telephone activity. 3.4 billion. We need help. Your cell phone service is taking aim at spammers and spoofers. If it seems as if you're getting more frequent robocalls, you're right. But help may be on the way. Next year, many mobile carriers plan to start rolling out a new line of defense, a kind of a caller authentication dubbed Stir and Shaken. The service is designed to cut down on spoofing, the trick spammers use to make their calls appear to come from a local number. Once Stir and Shaken is implemented by Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and other mobile companies, phone calls made on their networks will carry a digital key that will make it difficult for spammers to disguise their identities. There are plenty of other ways to cut down on the number of robocalls in your call history. Review options your phone provider offers for rejecting or screening anonymous calls, and consider third-party apps such as Umail or RoboKiller that automatically reject calls from suspect numbers. These apps aren't foolproof, but once Stir and Shaken is available, you can expect them to be more effective. The industry response has been to develop a new technology standard called STIR, which stands for Secure Telephony Identity Revisited, and SHAKEN, which stands for Secure Handling of Asserted Information Using Tokens, which defines how telephone service providers should implement the STIR technology to ensure calling numbers are not spoofed. Experts in the telecom industry have devised a new system to stop robocalls. The system attaches a certificate of authenticity to each phone number, adding an extra layer of verification while preventing spoofing. Fraudsters have been relying on spoofing and voice over internet protocols, that's VoIP, and the technology has begun to be adopted by more and more telecom companies. The days of being bombarded with robocalls, hopefully, may soon be over. Robocalls have gotten drastically worse in recent years, with the FTC receiving 7.1 million consumer complaints about robocalls in 2017, up from 5.3 million in 2016. The system is rolling out slowly among carriers and other organizations, with Verizon pledging to add to it in its mobile network. However, it's only available in the United States for now, despite robocalls being a global nuisance. The advent of cheap and easy-to-use technologies has spurred a rise in robocalls, overpowering the FCC rules that were meant to protect the consumer. Many popular services like Google Voice and Skype use Voice over Internet protocol, which allow users to call people around the globe on the cheap. With VoIP technology unlikely to go away, engineers and phone carriers are now trying to put a stop to spoofing with the stir-and-shaken method. When someone places an outgoing call, it contains a certificate verifying that the call is truly coming from a certain number. That phone number is transferred to the incoming carrier, which then makes sure that the certificate matches a highly encrypted private key. The system would operate not unlike SSL certificates on the web or PGP encryption, a technology used in popular end-to-end encryption apps like WhatsApp or Telegram. More and more cyber criminals are using spoofing to pose as your bank, the IRS, or other organizations where people give sensitive financial details or other personal information. The telephone network we have now is, well, it's non-secure. This is applying the lessons of data networks to telephone networks. In order for stir and shaken to work, carriers on both ends of the cause have to be willing to participate. It is unclear what incoming phone calls would look like after being verified by the stir and shaken system. One solution might involve adding a Twitter-like verification check mark to phone numbers. Stir and shaken could also come at an additional price for the consumers, as it may create new overhead for phone companies. Experts also caution that it doesn't ensure that robocalls will go away forever. Instead, it may mean that consumers see fewer robocalls, making it much less lucrative for fraudsters and eventually leading to gradual decline in robocall activity. Amazon has been searching for a location for their second headquarter. Well, it's been reported by the New York Times that instead of having a second headquarter, they're going to have a second and a third headquarter. And as reported by the New York Times, it may be Queens. Long Island City skyline could grow if Amazon's plan to bring thousands of jobs to the Queens neighborhood pans out. New York City last week announced $180 million in new spending on Long Island City to bolster transit, fix the sewer system, and attract new good-paying jobs. Now it appears that spending was, in part, deliberately timed. Amazon is nearing a deal to name Long Island City. The other location in Amazon's plans is outside the Crystal City area of Arlington, Virginia, a Washington suburb. The two locations combined will have 50,000 employees as part of its workforce. And these jobs are, from what I've read, they're white-collar jobs. And they're saying the average pay will be about $100,000 a year. That's good news, if it's true. The arrival of Amazon in Long Island City could establish New York as a major technology hub. But some residents worry about the effects of so many newcomers on the neighborhood of gleaming apartment towers and low-rise manufacturing that is already straining from rapid growth. AVAS is ending their support for Windows XP and Vista. AVAS is an antivirus company, and they have announced that they will stop making available updates for Windows XP and Vista users. The date of the end of the support is January 2019. The company said that the demand to protect those systems had substantially waned in recent years, and at the same time that the need to protect Windows 7 systems and later has grown. AVAS has recommended its users to update their Windows operating system to the latest version of Windows, which is 10, so that they can continue to receive the latest security updates. On a different software front, Microsoft announces first paid-for $20 Linux distro for Windows 10 October 2018 update. Microsoft has announced two new Linux distributions for Windows 10 subsystem for Linux, that's WSL, including the first paid-for Linux distro called WLinux. WLinux is a Debian-based distro available for $20 from the Microsoft Store. The company also announced Ubuntu version 18.04, which will be available through the Microsoft Store as well. While Windows 10 October 2018 update is in the process of recovering from data loss bugs, Microsoft has announced that the Windows 10 version 18.09 will bring more support for Linux distros through the WSL. WSL enables Windows 10 to run various GNU Linux distros inside the operating systems as apps, offering access to Ubuntu, OpenSUSE, Debian, and other Linux distros. WLinux is a custom Linux distro built from Debian specifically for use on WSL. While other distros are available for WSL, WLinux is the first optimized for use by users of WSL. WLinux was built by Whitewater Foundry and being promoted as a fast Linux terminal environment for developers, and it can be downloaded from the Microsoft Store for $10. As for Ubuntu version 18.04, it can now be run on Windows 10 ARM architecture-based machines. If the distro is downloaded from the Microsoft Store, it will first check whether the user has an ARM-based device to properly install the version. And now from Dr. Alfred Poor with Health and Wearable Technologies, he will be covering using a laser to measure blood glucose levels. He'll cover a wearable personal pain management device, and finally, he'll be talking about a fuel cell for implanted sensors that run on glucose. I hope you like it.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Diabetes is a disease that affects millions of people worldwide at a cost of billions of dollars in healthcare costs annually, both in directly treating the disease and all the complications that can arise from it, including blindness and amputation and even death. And the way diabetes is treated these days typically relies on monitoring your blood glucose level. And the way this is done is you prick your finger, get a drop of blood, and the blood glucose level is measured by a little device. One of the problems with this is that it's an invasive process. You have to pierce your skin, you have to draw blood, and it's a little painful, and it's unpleasant, and it's inconvenient. And it would be much better if we could come up with a non-invasive way of measuring your blood sugar levels. A lot of people are looking at this, and we've talked about a number of different solutions that are being studied. But the highest goal is to come up with a way to do it optically. Just shine a light on your skin and be able to measure glucose levels that way. As it turns out, this is a very difficult thing to do, however. A lot of researchers actually believe that it may not be possible. Well, some researchers at the University of Missouri and MIT have come up with an optical solution that may work. The difference is that they're not using LEDs as the light source. LEDs are the tiny little solid-state devices that emit light of different colors. And this is what's typically used in your fitness bands and your smartwatches to measure heart rate and other biometric measures. The problem is no one's found a way reliably yet to use the light from LEDs to measure glucose. These researchers are using a laser because it's got much more coherent light and it's got light of a much more specific frequency. They shine this laser light directly on the skin and then look at the reflection, and from that they can deduce the blood sugar levels. This research is just getting started. They've only done testing with 20 healthy subjects, non-diabetics, and believe that they can correlate the changes in light with the different blood sugar levels. There's going to be a lot more research that needs to be done, but the other problem is, at this point, you have to hook up a laser to the person's skin in order to get a reading. So the laser portion has to be made much, much smaller or come up with some other equivalent light source that has the same properties that can be miniaturized. It's an interesting development. It's going to be quite a while before this could be modified and refined into something that could turn into a consumer device that could be used regularly. But it's an interesting first step, and there's hope that maybe somebody will be able to create a non-invasive light-based glucose level measuring system. A Another topic that we talk about a lot here is the opioid epidemic and ways that researchers are trying to figure out how to use alternative pain management therapies or modify traditional pain management so that less opioids are used and give patients better control over their pain. Well, the FDA has recently cleared a device made by Medtronic called MyPTM, a personal therapy manager. It's used to help manage chronic pain. Basically, what it does is it's a pump that injects pain medication, opioid pain medication, close to the spine where it can be more effective. The other thing about it is that it comes with a smartphone application that allows the patient to control when and how much pain relief they receive. As it turns out, this is very effective for patients who have intermittent pain, when they don't know precisely when the pain is going to come on. And it's more effective than the oral medication because they don't have to take it all the time. They can just essentially push the button and get the pain relief when they need it. The initial studies have shown that patients actually use much less medication this way. Now, there are safeguards built in. If the patient requests more medication than their healthcare provider has provided for them, the system won't give that extra medication, and it will also alert the healthcare providers that the patient has asked for the extra medication. So the whole process gives the patient more control, and as it turns out, it looks like it can help them get more relief using less medication. Wearable devices are great for health and medical applications because they're able to provide round-the-clock, 24/7 sensing of different biometric measures, and you get much more information than you would get if you were to just go into the doctor's office and get your vital signs taken. Much more information, and very useful to have all that extra data to see how your systems change throughout the day and not just get those snapshots every once in a while. One of the problems with wearables is that you have to put them on, and you have to keep them recharged. Patients don't always wear them, so you don't always get the data collected. A much better way would be to actually implant the sensors into the body of the patient, and then it could provide continuous data, and you'd never have to forget about putting it on. It would just always be with you. The problem here is, how do you power it? We already have implants like pacemakers that run on electrical power, but the heart pacemakers have to have the battery replaced every 3 or 4 years. And this poses some risk to the patient. It would be much better if the pacemaker could just run indefinitely without having to change the batteries. So as a result, researchers have looked at a number of different ways to try to get power to an implanted device. They use ultrasound, they've used radio waves, they've used ways of capturing energy from motion. So a number of different things have been tried. Well, researchers at Washington State University have come up with a new way to power implanted sensors. They use the body's own energy. What they've come up with is a fuel cell, which is a device that takes a chemical, a certain kind of chemical, and converts it into electrical energy. And in this case, the fuel that it uses is glucose, the same blood sugar that your body uses to transport energy to different parts of the body. By absorbing the glucose that's passing by it in your body's system, it can generate enough power to do useful work. They've already done experiments integrating with other electronics to demonstrate that it can process signals at a high accuracy level. The next steps will be to increase the amount of power that it can generate, then start looking at getting FDA approval and connecting it with useful implantable sensors. The net effect is that we could end up with a bio device that could provide data about your body's operations for a lifetime. It would never need to be recharged or replaced, and it would just burn the fuel that you've got present in your body already.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. What do you do when your computer seems to be running with a mind of its own? There are apps when installed that refuses to be uninstalled. There are instances when your Windows operating system appears to be running out of control. You run the registry cleaner. You clean up extraneous files with Crap Cleaner or CCleaner. It didn't help at all. Your first step is to do a system restore to a date prior to the date of the problem. If you did not have the saving the system restore point set on, well, then you've had a teachable lesson. In most cases, it does solve the problem. But what if that doesn't fix the problem? What's next? You go to Plan B. Use the system file checker tool that's built into Windows to repair missing or corrupted system files. If some Windows functions aren't working or Windows crashes, use the system file checker to scan Windows and restore your files. How do you do it? Well, get into command mode in administrative mode and then run system file checker, that's SFC. That's SFC space / scan now. I'll repeat that again. SFC space / scan now, and then you press enter. This will take a while to run. Just be patient. Go out and have a mug of coffee. Wait a minute, change that to a carafe full of coffee. I've run SFC on computers and it either returns a report of no problems or it reports it has found problems and fixed them. In rare cases, it does report corruption found and not able to do a fix. When that happens, you go to Plan C. Microsoft has a Fix-It utility. Just do a search in the URL typing the following: Microsoft space fix space it space tool. I'll repeat it again. It's Microsoft Fix-It tool. If you're not on the computer that has the problem, just save the troubleshooter to a flash drive and then run it on the computer that has the problem. What does this fix? Corrupted registry keys on a 64-bit operating system. Corrupted register keys that control the update data. Problems that prevent new programs from being installed. Problems that prevent existing programs from being completely uninstalled or updated. Problems that block you from uninstalling a program through add or remove programs or programs and features in the control panel. If the problem persists, then go to Plan D, which is to rebuild the operating system. By the way, you did do backup on your data on a regular basis, right? Let's say you need to reinstall the Windows operating system. When you purchase a system today, the distribution version of the operating system is stored in hidden partitions. If it was a Windows 10 operating system on the computer, a factory reset will get you back to the release version of Windows 10 at the time of purchase. After the reinstallation over time, your computer will be upgraded to the latest version of Windows 10. You will need only to reinstall the applications originally on the system with the associated data from your backup files. But what if the factory reset gets you back to Windows 7, which you had subsequently upgraded to Windows 10? The free upgrade of Windows 7 to 10 from Microsoft terminated at the end of 2016. There were Microsoft Windows build releases, version 1507, 1511, and 1607 prior to the beginning of 2017. If you have downloaded any one of those releases, you can still do a free upgrade of Windows 7 to Windows 10. These Windows 10 build versions are still available from Microsoft, but at a price. They are available from third-party sources, free. One site is windowsiso.net. That's windowsiso.net. Even if you don't need it today, but the hidden partitions is Windows 7, download the appropriate build release before Microsoft formally requests third-party sites to cease distribution. The downloaded file is in ISO or image format. When you open the ISO file in Windows 10, you have opened a subdirectory of all the files in the Windows 10 distribution. Copy these files onto a USB drive and run the setup.exe to upgrade your Windows 7 to 10. You can run a clean install instead of the upgrade if you have the Windows 7 product code. What if you had mislaid the product 7 product code? What do you do then? And you don't have it readily available. Simple. Download the program Magical Jelly Bean, and when you run that program, it will tell you what the product code is, but do this before you begin any upgrade or reinstallation of Windows 10. Marty Winston enlisted in the U.S. Air Force during the Vietnam era. He was in the Air Force Systems Command. Let's hear from Marty tell of his experience without violating anything that may still be classified.
Are you a veteran? Thank you for your service. I'm a veteran, and it was an honor to serve. It was also a very rich context for learning in places where seasoned pros and some very young men and women would work side by side on many kinds of projects. I enlisted in the Air Force in 1967, and to all the wise guys who can't wait to ask, yes, we did have airplanes back then. We weren't still trying to fly with feathers and glue. It was the Vietnam era, and I had it a lot easier than most of my contemporaries. I never officially saw combat. I use the word officially to stay truthful without disclosing anything that might still be classified, but obviously, whatever I went through, I survived, and I am grateful for that. I had an admittedly soft and easy set of assignments, beginning with 3 years in Dayton, Ohio at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, working in a basement TV studio. I got transferred to an Army-run base in Seoul, Korea, and the studio of AFKN-TV, the Korean arm of AFRTS, the American Forces Radio and Television Service. These were my military day jobs. They were not all I did, but they are all I'll tell you about. That studio at Wright-Patterson had a videotape machine, a little bigger than an upright piano. It was inside a Faraday cage, meaning a grounded metal mesh with extra copper straps for improved earth connections. That was shielding to keep the video signals that were being read from the tape and amplified from being intercepted by enemy snoops. We were part of the Systems Division of the Air Force Systems Command, the people who specify new deployable aircraft. When I was there, the division was just wrapping up the design of the C-5A cargo plane. Wright-Patterson also had a scientific unit, a foreign intelligence unit, a logistics unit, and a SAC base. Very noisy SAC base. There were some interesting detours, but this is where I gathered a lot of hands-on information about TV lighting, camera operations, lens choices, microphone placements, audio and video switching and mixing, composing shots, and so forth. There was not very much in the equipment we used back then that's very relevant today. My video camera today is the size of a pound of butter, while the one we used back then was almost the size of a Mini Cooper on a one-post hydraulic lift with a hefty triangular base on wheels. My Korea duties were a little different because we were scheduling and running mostly pre-recorded content to distribute across South Korea, a country about the size of Indiana. I was doing more audio editing, film editing, handling film projector to video chains, producing, directing, writing, set design, prop design, and more. But you're not listening today to learn about my early broadcast years. Now that I've moved our focus to Korea, I mostly want to introduce you to the technology of our housing there and the lessons I learned from it. Have you ever heard of a Quonset hut? Imagine cutting a gigantic corrugated steel cylinder lengthwise and just using one of the cylinder's halves. Put the open side down and you have a Quonset hut. The steel was galvanized and painted, but that was the extent of its insulation. The floors were concrete. The walls between our bed areas were made by hanging blankets. The Quonset huts could keep the rain and snow off of us, but couldn't do much about the heat and cold. In the summer, the doors would be open and big fans would blow. But remember, fans only cool you by evaporating your sweat. They don't really cool the interior. In the winter, there were 55-gallon drums at both ends converted into oil-fueled heaters. They produced a lot of heat, usually too much heat, and they made the air almost cruelly dry. Buckets of water got placed on top of the heaters, and that would help a little, but dry eyes and dry throats and half the hut fighting colds made for a total absence of luxuriousness. I came up with a trick to compensate that, and you may still find that useful today. Here's what I did. I went to the PX and bought the biggest bath towel they had. I put a chair right next to the bed, right next to my bed, its back as close as possible to where my head met the pillow. I got that big towel soaking wet. Not quite dripping wet, but soaking wet, and I spread it out as broadsheet as possible over the back of the chair. In those hot surroundings, that wet towel infused enough of its moisture into the immediately surrounding air to create a bubble of more comfortable humidity that helped me sleep and helped me stay away from sick call. You can do that same trick today. Think of it as a cheapskate's humidifier. Dry throat, dry eyes, maybe some cold symptoms. Long-term, buy a humidifier. Short-term, broadly hang a wet towel near the head of the bed. I'd also like to touch on security, more or less. The AFKN facility in Korea, meaning the building with its studios and offices, was a cinder block building. AFRTS stations tended to be mixed service, meaning more than one military service was there, mixed service operations. So while I was Air Force, it was on an Army base with guards at the gates. One afternoon, there was a phoned bomb threat. As I remember being told, it was the voice of a native English speaker who seemed to have been drinking, but there was no choice but to respond to the threat as real and serious. The military police were alerted, and gate entry security was enhanced, tightened down. The AFKN building was evacuated, and everyone, all of us, everyone assigned there was told to go to the surrounding lawn and wait, prone, on the ground, until either something happened or we got an all clear. The radio station was broadcasting programs that came in on vinyl records, LPs. The TV station was running programs on film reels. Was the bomb threat a prank? And if the stations went off the air, would it embolden the perpetrators into trying again and maybe escalating? The staffers on the lawn couldn't be seen from surrounding roads. The theory was that if the threat turned out to be real, it would originate from one of the roads near one of the neighboring facilities, and the bomb would get lobbed from there. Out in the lawn, they asked for a volunteer to go back into the building and, on schedule, switch between records at the radio station and switch between the two projectors on the film chain. I volunteered, and being brave had nothing to do with it. I reasoned that a lobbed bomb, or even dynamite, had about as much chance of hurting people on the lawn as it did of hitting the building. I also reasoned that if there really was a bomb, I'd be a lot safer inside a cinder block building than I ever could be out on the lawn. I guess that depends on the bomb. That time, happily, it was an empty threat. The stations didn't go off the air, and the threat wasn't repeated or escalated. It's not that the building was in any way bomb-proof, but as I've said before, my 10th grade physics teacher did a great job of helping me understand the physics of the situation. The indoor tasks would only take me near the outer envelope of the building for about 2 minutes. The other chores all involved internal areas where additional walls could help absorb any blast. To be honest, I took my time in there and dawdled a bit before coming back outdoors. Indoors was a lot more comfortable. By that time, I was a staff sergeant, an NCO, and I can't say whether the others thought of me as a hero or as an idiot, but I can say it was among the earliest moments when I began thinking about the physics of structures. Make no mistake, nothing I did in the service was heroic or risky, even when there was a black market contract on me and a killer assigned to execute it. Even when I was in the middle of protest confrontations, even when police suspected me of being about to start something, and the same again at one point with the Secret Service. None of that was meritorious, and I would never want my little adventures to be compared to the true bravery and determination of the troops facing real bullets and real threats every day. My dad was in World War II, 82nd Airborne Glider Infantry, deeply and desperately involved in the Battle of the Bulge. I do understand and appreciate how very different their circumstances were from mine. So, to veterans everywhere, again, I salute you, and again, I thank you for your service. To the families of veterans everywhere, I honor the uncertainties that you had to endure. And to those serving now, those next graduating classes of veterans, my prayers are with you. Return home safe. A peaceful Veterans Day to all. And with that, I return this to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty, and we thank you for your service. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its meeting Thursday, November the 8th, 2018 at 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is Navigating Streaming Services. Meeting will be at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 411 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have a presentation on file transfer from Mac to iOS devices. Friday, November the 9th, meeting time is 7 p.m., and they will meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall at the New York Institute of Technology out in Old Westbury campus in Old Westbury, New York. The Princeton PC Users Group will have a presentation on Cool Holiday Tech. It's Tuesday, November the 27th at 7 p.m. at Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group, which is otherwise known as BCUG, will have a presentation on Current Trends in Personal Technology, Thursday, November the 29th, in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society, DAX, will meet Tuesday, December the 4th, 7:30 p.m. Location is the Danbury Hospital Creasy Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on new technology toys for the holidays, Tuesday, December the 4th, 1:30 p.m. at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have its meeting December the 7th at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Westchester PC User Group hasn't given me a firm date yet, but you can go to their website at wpcug.org for more information, and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or BAI.org, streaming on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. Back up, and pretty please, back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.